Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Four objects and an oil slick in the Java Sea, where searchers are looking for Asia Air Flight 8501. And the U.S. imposes new sanctions on North Korea. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Indonesian search and recovery teams hunting for the wreck of Air Asia Flight 8501 have located objects and an oil slick on the surface of the Java Sea. But as Ron Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok.
At a news conference Saturday, National Rescue Agency Chief Bambang Soloyistio said the four objects under the sea and oil slick had been found despite stormy weather. Soloyistio said the objects were spotted in relatively shallow waters of around 30 meters deep. 30 bodies have been retrieved from the sea and were transported to Surabaya for identification. Images from inside a C-130 transport plane show white numbered caskets in line next to one another. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
The outgoing head of the United Nations Mission for Ebola Emergency Response says the worst outbreak of the disease can be ended this year. Speaking in Accra, Guinea, Anthony Banbury said significant progress has been made in fighting Ebola since he was appointed in September, but he states the crisis is far from over.
And we're going to do it by working very closely, not just with the governments of the countries, but the communities.
Mr. Banbury stressed that reaching zero Ebola cases is the only acceptable outcome. He said when the UN mission began last year, there were predictions that as many as 1.4 million people would be affected by the start of 2015. Currently, the number of infections is at 20,206, according to the World Health Organization. This is VOA News. The United States has imposed new sanctions on North Korea in response to the cyber attack on Sony Pictures Entertainment late last year. President Barack Obama Friday signed an executive order authorizing the sanctions. The White House says the sanctions, which target three organizations and 10 individuals, are a first step in seeking to punish North Korea for numerous provocations, including the cyber attack. The U.S. has sanctions in place against North Korea in relation to the North's nuclear program. This is the first time sanctions have been imposed related to cybersecurity. Firefighters in Australia are struggling to control huge blazes that have destroyed homes and forced hundreds to flee. Near Adelaide, five homes have been destroyed and hundreds of others are at risk after strong winds fanned the flames. Authorities have asked residents of 19 communities to evacuate. Jay Weatherhill is the Premier of South Australia.
I need to impress on those South Australians who are living in and around the southern Mount Lofty ranges that we are dealing with an incredibly dangerous fire. Your life is at risk, and we're asking you to implement your bushfire survival plans.
There have been no serious injuries reported, but another home was lost in Victoria State. Dry conditions and temperatures near 40 degrees Celsius are hindering the efforts to control the fire, with as many as 2,000 fighters battling the blazes from air and ground. Five firefighters are dead in a warehouse blaze in northeastern China. Chinese state media say the victims died when an upper floor collapsed onto them late Friday, trapping them in debris as they attempted to put out the fire in Harbin City. More than a dozen other firefighters were injured at the warehouse, which is part of a residential building. Several people were evacuated. The cause of the fire is being investigated. Palestinians have submitted documents to the United Nations in order to join the International Criminal Court, a move that will enable them to seek war crimes charges against Israel. The Palestinian ambassador to the UN, Riyad Mansour, confirmed the handoff of documents at the UN headquarters.
I have delivered the 14 copies of the accession of conventions and treaties in which the state of Palestine has joined.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas signed the documents after the UN Security Council rejected a draft resolution earlier this week, setting the three-year deadline for the establishment of a Palestinian state on lands occupied by Israel after the 1967 war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is threatening unspecified retaliation for the Palestinians' request to join the ICC. And a suspected Libyan al-Qaeda member has died just days before he was to start trial in New York for the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Africa. Abu Anas al-Libi perished Friday. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
I received information that the military police had deployed heavily at his residence. So I tried to go to his place and so that I could talk to him.
The Ugandan government places renegade General Sejusa under house arrest. We'll have details.
As a Kenyan who is also alive to the charges that we are going through as a country, I don't actually agree with the decision of the court, and I'm going to urge the government to appeal.
A Kenyan parliamentarian urges government to implement a controversial anti-terrorism law, despite a court ruling striking down segments of the new law.
We were not subject to, you know, the rules of the Electoral Code of Conduct, which requires that the media provides, you know, wide coverage for all the political parties that are participating in an election.
And the Economics Association of Zambia wants to reschedule a cancelled presidential debate among candidates contesting the upcoming by-election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A defense attorney is demanding answers from the Ugandan government after renegade General David Sejusa was placed under house arrest on Friday. Ladislaw Rakafuzi told me earlier that he was prevented from meeting Sejusa due to the deployment of heavy military personnel at his house.
I received information that the military police had deployed heavily at his residence, so I tried to go to his place and so that I could talk to him. The military said I couldn't. They said they did not know me as one of his lawyers, and they were not allowing people to get into his house or people to come out of his house.
Were you able to speak to him on phone after hearing that he's been placed under house arrest?
I have spoken to him on phone every 2 hours since then, and I last talked to him 2 hours ago.
Is the government or officials or the military officials explaining why he was placed under house arrest?
Yes, they claim that they are reinforcing his security, because they have learned that he is insecure, and that's why they have deployed heavily in and outside his house.
So does that mean that they are denying that he's been placed under house arrest, if indeed in this case they are protecting him?
Yeah, certainly they are denying that they have placed him under house arrest, because first of all, for them to admit that they have placed him under house arrest, it would be illegal, because our law does not envisage house arrest. All arrests must be done in a known place, a place of detention. So house arrests are not allowed under our law. So that's why they are refusing to admit that they have indeed put him under house arrest.
There are concerns that statement that General Sejusa has made basically undermines the rules governing military personnel in the country or the security agencies in the country, and they believe that he deserves what he is getting at the moment. As his lawyer, what is your response to such criticisms?
Sejusa yesterday addressed the press, and he said that he's not a career soldier. He joined the army in his youth, at the age of 30, after university, and he had seen that a lot had gone bad politically in his country and wanted to change that. He was not seeking a job in the army. He only had those ideals of any youth who wished to make changes to the political trends in his country. And that therefore, he needs to leave the army. He needs to be retired, because he has served 34 years, and he thinks that is sufficient. it's a long service, and he needs to leave the army, and that his application to leave the army should be considered legally and not there is somebody who has to calculate political expedience out of it.
He's still a member of the military, and therefore some of the statements he made, like forcing President Museveni to leave when he is the commander-in-chief of the army, basically is treasonous, some people say.
Yeah, he made some political statements, but he's entitled to making those statements because the Constitution allows him. He's not excluded from making political statements, and he has always expressed his desire to leave the army since 1995. So he wants to leave the army so that he can actively participate in politics. So they should not hold it against him because he has always wanted to leave the army.
What is your next line of action as his lawyer? The government is denying that he's placed under house arrest, and the fact that you were prevented from going to see him with heavy security at his presence, not allowing anybody in or out. What is your next line of action?
Well, this is a weekend. Therefore, there's very little we can do because most of our work is through the courts. Secondly, we need to hear from government as to why they are keeping him. And if they state that they have placed him under house arrest, then we shall challenge that as being unlawful. But if they do not state so, we can still challenge it because he himself does not need that protection, and he has said so in very clear words.
That was Ladislaw Rakafuzi, the defense attorney for the Ugandan renegade general David Sejusa. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. And for the latest update regarding Sejusa's house arrest, Emmanuel Okela, the news editor at Radio Simba, an independent radio station, joins us live via telephone link up from Kampala. Good evening, Emmanuel.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Emmanuel, there are conflicting reports that General Sejusa was taken away by the military. Some are saying he's still at home. What can you tell us about the latest development?
What happened, actually, that confusion happened because this is confinement yesterday. A general visited his home today, General Eli Tumwine, who is known actually as his friend and a bushwar comrade. They had a private discussion in his house, and then they left in a motorcade. Initially, everyone thought that he had been actually arrested. But what we are learning now is that that trip they made was to State House Entebbe, where he held a brief meeting of about 30 minutes with His Excellency the President. The details of that meeting are still privy, but what is known now is that they have struck some deal, which includes a request to General Sejusa to stop making media and public utterances, and also a request by Sejusa to have his application to retire from the army granted. So we've just been going to his home, where he's been brought now, and what the lawyers told us, the military didn't allow us to speak to him. But the lawyers told us that they had also accepted with the president. They had a meeting. In that meeting, they agreed that they withdraw the soldiers from his compound.
Now,
Emmanuel, he's at his home in Naguru.
Now, Emmanuel, President Museveni initially invited Sejusa for a meeting at his country home. Sejusa turned it down, citing instances of issues he raised that needed to be addressed. Was this brought up?
Yes. According to the lawyers, they had about five issues that were raised, including the two that I've mentioned. That is his retirement from the army. Two, he has also been ordered to stop making public utterances. At this point, it's very difficult to know what exactly the detail in total. But what we know is that the meeting finally happened today at State House. And whereas much has not been said. They agreed again to have another meeting subsequent to this one, which we hope will now include the issues and conditions they were setting.
Now, Emmanuel, how are Ugandans reacting to this Sejusa saga?
I could say it is it's a mix of both suspicion and excitement. Suspicion mainly because Sejusa has a history of falling in the ranks with the president over certain fundamental issues. But being comrades, they have always had a way of getting back together. So when he returned, when he made the surprise return from exile, it was seen with suspicion by the opposition members who now thought that maybe he was on a spy mission abroad. And even when he came back, very few opposition members were free to openly associate with him over that, because they said, this is a man we know. In 1994, he broke up with Museveni, but only went back again. So we are not so sure. So many people, actually, we've been gathering some views on the streets, and people are saying this is just political drama that they're not so eager about.
Now, Emmanuel, let me ask you
now,
this.
The meeting today put some credence to that kind of suspicion.
Now,
so
this
is a mix of both.
Right. Talking about the meeting today and the deal they signed, wouldn't this alienate him further from the opposition, since he's been calling for them to embrace him to fight President Museveni to remove him from office?
Exactly. This is the point, because he's been saying he's been vocal, and some people had started believing him, especially following the most recent outburst where he said, I've shunned a meeting called by the president. I have conditions. I am not on the side of government. I am not for reconciliation. I'm here to fight the regime. So a meeting like this definitely casts doubt on whether he was actually serious about that.
Thank you.
Now,
thank you very much.
Thank you
very much. Emmanuel Okela is the news editor at Radio Simba, a Ugandan independent radio station. He just spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. A leading member of the Kenyan Parliament House Committee on Justice and Legal Affairs has called on the government to appeal a court ruling that suspended part of a controversial anti-terrorism law. Parliamentarian Peter Njoroge Baiya told me that they disagreed with the court ruling, saying lawmakers considered the country's security challenges as well as concerns of the opponents before passing the measure in Parliament.
The court has a constitutional responsibility to make the decision it made. But as a Kenyan who is also alive to the charges that we are going through as a country, I don't actually agree with the decision of the court. And I'm going to urge the government to appeal against that decision as a matter of urgency.
Why do you think the government should appeal against it? Because opponents of the law are saying that the government could use this to curtail civil liberties and take Kenya back to the days of torture, among other issues and concerns about the law signed by President Kenyatta.
I'm saying so because as parliament, we had opportunity to actually consider those roles and all the various provisions, and those that could have been abused, we actually were able to remove them at the level of registration. So all the various registration we passed were clearly earmarked to address the security challenges currently prevailing in the country. So we believe that the civil societies and opposition, they are basically not concerned or even interested about the charges of insecurity in this country. We cannot really talk about liberties when the limbs and lives are being lost on account of the insecurity. perpetrated by the terrorists.
Honorable Baiya, your fellow legislators and parliamentarians are saying that there are existing security laws that the government has yet to implement to protect Kenyans instead of strengthening this, what they call, draconian laws that will undermine civil liberties as well as freedom of speech, which is guaranteed in the Kenyan constitution.
The truth is that most of the draconian aspects of the law that we have proposed from the executive, we actually, as parliament, we rejected them. And specific legislation we passed are basically geared to enhance coordination of the security agencies, to actually demand responsibility in the law enforcement itself. If that is what the court is setting aside, I personally don't agree with it.
You have urged the government to appeal to the decision of the court, but don't you think that the country needs unanimity in order to fight against terrorism? If the country is divided on these lines of a law to protect every Tom, Dick and Harry in the country, don't you think that this controversial law defeats the purpose of unity to fight these terrorists?
My belief is that it is true the country needs to build consensus even on security laws, but on terrorism. But the biggest problem we are having is that there are some interests that don't want even the government to succeed in combating terrorism or in combating insecurity in the country. So they will hit, or they will actually take as excuses that the rules are contravening civil liberties and so on and so forth. But their ultimate aim is to ensure that the government does not deliver on security.
Are you therefore saying these are saboteurs who want to undermine the government? Are you saying that these people who are opponents of the government are being unpatriotic?
There are actually considerable forces which are leading, hedging themselves on civil liberties, but their main intention is actually to sabotage the government.
Do you have proof of these allegations you're making, Mr. Parliamentarian?
Well, it's in public domain. Some of the possessions, some of the people take. We know there are actually people who actually are feeling threatened because some of their communities, for instance, have people suspected of involvement in terrorism activities. So you don't have to ask why they are taking some of those positions. It is because they believe that the law could be used to follow some of the suspects who are themselves known terrorists.
Are you therefore going to raise this matter up in Parliament when Parliament resumes?
We will pursue. No. I believe that the legitimate recourse, once the court has made decision, is actually to appeal against that decision. It is actually to appeal against that decision. But we have not really led fully the ruling of the court, so that we can really be able to say how significant the clauses of the law which have been stated are going to be as far as the strategy for combating terrorism in the country is concerned.
Peter Njoroge Baiya is a leading member of the Kenyan Parliament's House Committee on Justice and Legal Affairs. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi. The chairman of the Economics Association of Zambia says his group is working with political parties to hold a presidential debate before the January 20 election after a previously scheduled one was cancelled. Isaac Ngoma told me that his organization is committed to providing Zambian voters the opportunity to hear from the candidates.
We did work very hard. Of course, it's been a process. It started way back by the beginning of the month. But unfortunately, when the climax of the process was coming to the D-Day, we were unable to hold the event at the last minute because, first and foremost, we had the petition coming in from one of the smaller political parties who petitioned the Electoral Commission that were being discriminated against because we had left them out from the debate. That's one. Then secondly, we had the ruling political party, the candidate, not availing himself because we were informed that he was caught up on his campaign trail in the northern region of the country.
So, Mr. Ngoma, there were so many things that appear to have undermined the effort to organize this presidential debate.
Actually, it's two major things. But I reckon that this shouldn't have happened because, first and foremost, there was commitment from everyone. We also got clearance from the Electoral Commission that being a private organization and sponsoring the program as a paid-for program, we were not subject to, you know, the rules of the Electoral Code of Conduct, which requires that the media provides, you know, wide coverage for all the political parties that are participating in an election. But this one, we use a criteria that was suitable in accordance to our objectives for the event. We were looking at candidates who had political parties with representation in Parliament, in the National Assembly, those that have got seats in Parliament, first and foremost. So that makes it the four front runners. So we're looking at that as the basis upon which we picked on the four. And even on the ground, if you were to assess and just check what the mood is like, those are the four front runners and the main contestants that are being seen to be in the running for this election.
So, Mr. Ngoma, how is your organization going to talk to the people of Zambia following this disappointment, especially when it was much anticipated and much publicized that this debate was going to occur?
True. Much anticipated and highly publicized. We are hoping that we can get the political parties to come around and ensure that this debate goes on, because there's commitment. Right from the beginning, we had received overwhelming support and commitment from each of the political parties that we had lined up for the debate. And they actually signed a memorandum of understanding that we had put up to ensure that they participate in this debate. So going forward, we've started talking to them now, trying to come up with another suitable date on which this can be done. We understand that the time that we have is pretty tight, short, and they're also busy campaigning, canvassing for votes in the countryside, but they can surely make some time and get back into the capital city and do this thing for only 2 hours. So it's only 2 hours that we're asking for, and the excitement on the ground and anticipation is very high. Everyone is looking forward to hear, because this was to be broadcast nationwide on both television and also to be broadcast on radio. We even had other private radio stations that were going to broadcast this live, you know, at their own cost. And we have all these online media guys and the print media. They were all ready to cover this. So everyone was glued to their seats, and everyone is supportive of the fact that we need to pursue the political parties and ensure that this takes place. And this has been our job in this day. We've been busy just trying to get around the political parties to, you know, get them to at least to recommit. But those that we had, they made firm commitments that they'll be available at short notice.
Isaac Ngoma is the chairman of the Economics Association of Zambia. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one I JJ. This one I JJ.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best. Right here on VOA Africa.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today.
Anything where you they do, my brother, woman go there. I say woman go there. If you invite proposals to your party, then go ask you whether woman go there. She be woman go there. Shall a woman they make you the kitty won't pay, the kitty won't pay. Still emphasizing, just the analyzing, hypnotizing is the hidden strength of a woman. Shy, looking at you, not the ghost. You go make plenty sense if you roll my boat. Tumwa bukwa ne ba no eh. African baby, oh, una ula no ula no ula no ula no no di endao. From the garden of Eden, don't they know be today? Beauty they brought they throw away. Boys don't they give maro? I'm a little baby, oh. Whether woman go there, for sure. She be woman go there. Shall a woman they make you the kitty won't pay, the kitty won't pay, the kitty won't pay. A woman they make you the kitty won't pay, the kitty won't pay, the kitty won't pay. Shall a woman they make you the kitty won't pay, the kitty won't pay, the kitty won't pay. Shall a woman they make you the kitty won't pay, the kitty won't pay, the kitty won't pay. The woman go there, it's more in the cry. The woman go there, even got the bottom on you. Go so feed the ego failure.
Don't underestimate my power.
As for my beautiful lady, me I go love you well, well. I go do you sorry, sorry. Make we they go. I'm gonna jam my paro. Cause without you, baby, man, go lonely. Anything where you they do, my brother, yeah.
Woman go there, for sure.
I say woman go there.
Baby, let me fresh from loving. The way you moving your body from left and right to somebody. I mean, they pop. Look at them and them look at you. Everybody just feeling you, mama, mama, just feeling you. Baby, mama, mama, mama. You like to the balaga. Shop in the banana. Come and shop in the banana.
You got to get past your hobby. my chubby, my love be for me. My Lulu send my over there for me. My money, my city, my honey. But this shit I mean, I mean, she never be be. But when it didn't, we see a friend who leave. Leave my when I'm a mess, we leave. Who for the area, what's in there, be? Who for the theater, any minute you walk up, get my baby, till I am got kicker. Who better be here, who better be faster? Who better be a man, no panza? Can you have a man, I'm a master? Maybe I'm who to hope, three baby.
Familia, girl, we are familia, 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 familia,
Continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to share my reflections on U.S. policy toward that continent. Every passing week, I pay a great deal of attention to the headlines, both in the U.S. and on the continent. And of course, I try to figure out major trends that are likely to affect America's policy towards Africa and to look at African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. As we enter the beginning of the year 2015, a number of issues are on the horizons. And the broadcasters, journalists, bloggers, and academicians who are looking at Africa and the relations with America focus on these points. There are 4 points I want to emphasize quickly in the interest of time. Number one, President Obama's new relationship with the Republican-dominated Congress has implications for Africa also, because one of his major challenges is to make sure that American humanitarian policy towards West Africa, particularly those countries affected by Ebola, would be discussed throughout the 2015. There are going to be significant breakthroughs through research coming from the members of the World Health Organization dealing with Ebola in DRC, where it originally started, and it was neglected without serious attention on the part of political leadership from DRC during Mobutu's time. And the issue became important when we had a serious outbreak in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Today, the African leaders of the African Union will have to go back to square one and begin to look at diseases in African societies and how diseases in African societies are grappled by Africans themselves. Now that you have over 50 African states that are member states in the United Nations, and they are engaged with the United States in a number of ways. President Obama's summit provided an important point of discourse before Ebola came out and destroyed the scene, and the African summit was relegated to the background. So that is number one issue, which is really critical for anyone looking at U.S. policy towards Africa or looking at African opinions on and attitudes towards change. Now, as we move toward 2015, what I call during the time of Mao Gaddafi's problems, when we talk about the Tunisian crisis, many people talk about the Arab Spring. I think many people are now skeptical about whether there was really an Arab Spring or not an Arab Spring at all. Even some of those young activists who were fighting in Egypt went to Tahrir Square and were jumping up and down about democracy, liberalism, and et cetera. But now the tide has turned radically against many of those liberal intellectuals who couldn't work out a deal with the Islamists, and they're paying the price of the return of the military dictatorship in Egypt. So what I call at that time the political hamatang flowing over Africa has started. Before the end of the year, we saw the threat of a long-standing dictator out of Burkina Faso. So those of us who are concerned about American policy towards Africa will now see 2015 as a new beginning. Samuel Huntington talked about the democratic transformation even during the Cold War. And there are many scholars who write about Africa who are very concerned about this. Some of our colleagues writing on Nigeria, talking about democracy, are going to bring the debate back again with regard to the new elections taking place in Nigeria. So diseases, public policy, public finance are going to be big issues in 2015. And it's going to affect America's relations with Africa. And this will also affect President Obama's legacy in Africa in the year 2015. The third point that has to be addressed here deals with public finance. Public finance. Public finance. Stupid. When you talk about the democratic process in Nigeria, and you want the Nigerians to move to a higher level of governance and political responsibility, the big issue this year for the Obama administration is, how are they going to look at the Nigerian election and see it's going to be free and fair? And the Nigerians themselves are going to have elections genuinely conducted without being scammed by any kind of political engineering or financial manipulation through the use of the oil. This is going to be the big issue for the Nigerians. Can we have democracy and the ballot box prevailing without bullets? The Boko Haram is the big scam in the country. Billions of dollars have been wasted fighting the Boko Haram. So what American policy must do is to make sure that if Americans cannot help the Nigerians in terms of dealing with Boko Haram or respond supportingly to them to deal with that issue between now and election, or at least create a national unity of the political parties to say that there will be serious negotiations to contain that religious element in Nigeria, which has created a lot of harm to many innocent people in that country. So this becomes the other issue that we address. The last point that has to be addressed here with regard to public finance, governance, and the establishment of the electoral process so they can have free and fair elections. This is very serious for Africa because, you see, since independence, the Africans were struggling with electoral systems. During the time of Kwame Nkrumah, the one-party dictatorship became the norm. And even Cote d'Ivoire, which was opposed, Ivory Coast, as it's called now, then at that time, Cote d'Ivoire now, Okeboanyi and Kwame Nkrumah were ideologically different, but they all united on the one-party dictatorship. That prevailed all over Africa until Leopold Senghor broke away from that rank and decided to allow political opposition in Senegal. And today, if you look at Africa, you can see the Ghanaians, the Botswanans, the Gambians, once upon a time used to be that way, but they have gone directly the other way in terms of being part of those few countries that were considered democratic. But unfortunately, because the dominance of the one-party system in that country muddied the water and destroyed the system to the point that you have a military dictatorship which began to produce the same one-party dominance in that country. Kwame Nkrumah came democratically, but unfortunately, he left as a dictator who was overthrown by the military. Rawlings, who came with the military, left gracefully as a Democrat, and the Ghanaians now benefit from both the legacy of Nkrumah and the legacy of Rawlings. And now today, the Ghanaians are traveling the path of democratization. That's the message Obama must leave in Africa as part of his second term.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline African comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, every day may not be good, but there's something good in each day. do a turnaround, and search for one thing good each day. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States Patent and Trademark Office, or USPTO, held its annual intellectual property, or IP, attaché meetings during the week of December 15. Each year since 2007, participants from the USPTO and other government agencies, organizations, associations, and universities attend the event to exchange information about international IP issues and the work of the USPTO's IP attachés. The meetings provide a platform for all 11 IP attachés to share their accomplishments, participate in briefings on patent, trademark, and copyright developments in the United States, brief stakeholders on the conditions in their regions, and collaborate with other organizations, stakeholders, and foreign IP attachés. The discussions facilitate information exchange and coordination with U.S. stakeholders with the goal of improving IP protection and enforcement abroad. The USPTO IP attaché program assigns experts to U.S. embassies and consulates overseas to represent the USPTO, advocate U.S. government policy positions on IP, and help countries to improve their administration and protection of IP. IP attachés have assisted many industry associations, businesses, and other U.S. stakeholders in their efforts to protect and enforce their IP rights and navigate local IP laws in regions around the world. Each IP attaché has expertise in the fields of international IP law, policy, and enforcement. In the week prior to the Alexandria meetings, IP attachés met with the public in San Francisco and San Jose, California, including representatives from high-tech organizations, legal associations, and universities. These interactions provided education and built contacts with a broad range of organizations interested in learning more about the IP attaché program and U.S. government IP policy overseas. As part of the event, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce sponsored a half-day discussion where IP attachés exchanged views with chamber members and the public. The discussion centered on ensuring that IP systems help protect U.S. interests abroad while reducing trade barriers and encouraging strong economic growth. Protecting the intellectual property rights of U.S. citizens is an important goal of United States policy. The world is a better and more productive place when inventors, artists, writers, scholars, performers, and others are guaranteed the rewards their labor and ingenuity have earned for them.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.